This morning, during our 9 o'clock session, we're honored to have Dr. Bryant Wood here with us again today to speak about information concerning Jericho. And this is a topic that is right up Dr. Wood's alley. After extensive work in the field of academia, earning degrees from Syracuse, Michigan, and the University of Toronto, PhD, Dr. Wood has done extensive archaeological research in the field, in Jordan, in Egypt, all around the Bible lands, and received international attention for some of the work concerning Jericho, which is what we get to hear about today. So without taking up any more of Dr. Wood's time, I'm going to hand it over. Please welcome Dr. Wood to the stage once again.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, this subject is one that is kind of dear to my heart because I've been doing research on this topic for, 20 years, I guess, or so. And new information keeps coming up, and so there's always something more to analyze and to work on, and hopefully in the near future I will put all this information together and get it published. I've published bits and pieces here and there, but haven't done the in-depth analysis or published the in-depth analysis. But I'll give you today a summary of the results of all of this research. Now, Jericho is one of the controversial places in Scripture concerning the correlation between archaeology and the Bible. If you read any textbook on Old Testament or any book about archaeology in the Bible, and you turn to the section about the conquest of Canaan, you will read that there seems to be a conflict between what has been found at Jericho and what the Bible says. And that conflict has led scholars to conclude that the biblical story is not right. So we're going to have a look at that conflict. And the reason why scholars come to these conclusions, a typical statement is the one I have here by H.J. Franken, where he says the archaeological evidence leaves no option but to accept that there was no LB, that stands for late bronze, the period of the conquest. There was no LB city of Jericho around 1400 B.C., and that really is the biblical date for the conquest. Many scholars say, no, it was 200 years later, and so he even throws in the later dating, about 1200. There was no LB city at Jericho, either at the early date for the conquest, what the Bible says is the right date, or this later kind of a scholarly idea that maybe it happened 200 years later. On or around Ain Es Sultan, that's the Arabic name of the site of Jericho. It simply means the spring of the Sultan, and there is a very copious spring there, a good water supply, and that's why people have settled at Jericho from the very earliest times. In fact, Jericho is considered one of the oldest cities in the world. So there was no LB city at this site. The huge ruins of the Hyksos city gave rise to the folk tale, okay, the folk tale attached to the hero Joshua. So what is he saying? He says the biblical account that we have in Joshua is not real history. It never happened. It was a folk story. Now, other scholars would use different terminology, but they would say the same basic thing. Many scholars say it's an etiology. That's kind of a big word. It simply means a story written up to explain something, like a ruin. And the local folks say, whoa, look at the ruins there. What happened there? Why are those ruins there? And so somebody spins out a tale. Oh, this is the place where our ancestors came, and they surrounded the city, and our God miraculously brought the walls down, and they captured the city, and they burned it, and it's been a ruin ever since. That's an etiology, according to scholars. And some say, that's what we have in the Bible. Not only Jericho, but they say there's other etiologies to explain other ruins and other things that we read about in the Bible. Well, of course, those of us in the ministry of the Associates for Biblical Research don't go along with these conclusions of scholars. We believe the Bible is God's Word. We believe it's inspired. We believe it's inerrant. And if there's a conflict between the findings of archaeology and the Bible, we want to examine the the findings of archaeology to see why there is this apparent discrepancy. And when you do the in-depth research and analysis of the archaeological data, every time you find that it's not the Bible that's wrong, it's the interpretations of the scholars that's wrong. And so we'll see how that works out here at Jericho. You remember, of course, how the Israelites had, at the end of the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, had come up along the east side of the Dead Sea and then camped on the north side of the Dead Sea at the plains of Moab. And from there, they crossed the Jordan River. God performed another great miracle at that time, damming up the waters of the Jordan. We'll talk a little bit about that. And the very first city they attacked in the area of Cisjordan, that is the area on the west side of the Jordan Valley, what is referred to as the land of Canaan or the promised land, the very first city the Israelites attacked was Jericho. And that gave them a foothold in the land of Canaan. From there, they proceeded. Let me back up a moment. You can see Jericho is located in the Jordan Valley. It's just a little bit northwest of the Sea of Galilee there, the Dead Sea. And it's in the Jordan Valley, a very low area there. But from there, they proceeded up into the hill country to the west, and they attacked the site of Ai. And then from there, they proceeded to the south. They had the southern campaign, defeated a number of cities in the south, and then went clear up to the north to Hazor, where they defeated a coalition of northern kings, and thereby gaining control of this central hill country of the area of Palestine. All of this did not happen in a short period of time. As you read through Joshua, you kind of get the idea this went bang, 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 bang. It might have taken a few months. No, it actually took 7 years for all of this to play out and for the conquest to be completed. And then, of course, the area that they had conquered was divided up amongst the 12 tribes. And then they had to continue kind of mop-up operations during the period of Judges. Well, anyway, that's kind of the overview. So Jordan River was the first barrier the Israelites faced. And as they God commanded them to bring the ark down to the edge of the water and to bring all the people to get ready to cross. And this is the account of how as they came to the Jordan River, the waters of the Jordan were dammed up, we're told, at a point further north from Jericho, at a place called Adam. And we have very descriptive language how the waters flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap. They're just dammed up a great distance away at Adam. Now this, of course, has been criticized by scholars. They say, oh, well, this is just part of the folk story, this miracle that took place. Well, when you look at the reality of the situation, the site of Jericho is in the Jordan Valley, which is part of the Great Rift System. It's a place where the earth has sunk down, and it's very unstable. Earthquakes happen quite often. And in fact, when an earthquake strikes there in the Jordan Valley, in a certain way, in a certain place, it will actually cause the banks of the Jordan River to collapse into the river and dam it up at the very place mentioned in the Bible, Adam. Well, to give you an idea of what the Jordan River looks like in flood, and of course the river was at flood stage when the Israelites crossed, this is a photo from 1940 showing how wide that flood is, and what a barrier that would have been to the Israelites as they came down to the edge of the river. But God caused this damming up of the river further north. Well, here we see on the map Adam, the site of the damming up, according to the Bible. And here we're looking down on the Jordan River at Adam. And you can see how the river flows very close to these high embankments, and that how an earthquake could dislodge these embankments and cause the river to be dammed up. We have a number of instances of that happening throughout history that have been recorded. The most recent occurrence was in 1927, I believe it was, a very well-documented event when the river was dammed up at a dam and did not flow for about 24 hours. So it's quite reasonable to think that God used an earthquake to accomplish His purpose in damming up that river at just the right time for the Israelites to cross over. Here's a view from the ground, again looking at those embankments there at Adam and how close they are to the river. This is the view the Israelites would have had of the site of Jericho as they approached it. You see today there in the center of the picture, it's nothing but a pile of dirt. But under that dirt, we have the remains of many phases of occupation. And the one we're interested in is the time of Joshua. So that's what we're going to be looking at. As the Israelites approached, they would have seen great and high walls around this city. There were actually two sets of walls. We see, of course, at the upper city here, a wall going around. But there was also a lower wall down here, which isn't shown in our reconstruction. This was done by John Garstang, who excavated at Jericho in the 1930s. He did a lot of good work there, but he did not quite understand the fortification system. Archaeology was still kind of in its early stages, and he did not have the technique to properly understand the fortification system of the city. There was a later archaeologist who worked there in the 1950s. Her name was Kathleen Kenyon. Both of these archaeologists were from England. And she used the more advanced techniques of excavating, and she straightened out for us the fortification system and how the different components fit together and so on. And we'll look at that in a moment. But for Garstang, he thought that lower wall that he shows in ruins was an earlier wall, and by the time of Joshua, it was no longer in use. That's not the case. The lower wall was in use as well, as we'll see as we look at the cross-section of the fortification system. Here's John Garstang as he looked in the 1930s, and Kathleen Kenyon, who worked there in the 1950s. So I present these two archaeologists because they had different conclusions about their findings at Jericho. John Garstang said that the city was destroyed about 1400 BC, violently destroyed by fire. And Kathleen Kenyon, when she came along and did her work in the 1950s, she said, oh, John Garstang was all wet. He was wrong. The city was really destroyed 150 years before that, and at the time of the conquest in about 1400, there was no city there. It had been abandoned. It had been destroyed 150 years earlier, and it lay in ruins. And so we have these two conflicting ideas. Now, of course, when Kenyon did her work, as I mentioned, she had a very good field technique and very scientific, what we call stratigraphic excavation, layer by layer, very carefully going down through the material. And she kind of specialized in the analysis of the vertical section of her trenches or squares. And that's what we call a balk. And by looking at that vertical cross-section, you actually have a record of the various events that had taken place in that ruin that you're excavating. You can see the destruction layer. You can see the rebuilding. You can see abandonment. You can see all kinds of things in that balk. And that's kind of her contribution to Palestinian archaeology, was doing this careful drawing, first of all, of that balk, and then the analysis to figure out what is the sequence that took place here. And so she had these advanced techniques that she put into practice there at Jericho in the 1950s. And so, of course, scholars would say, well, Kenyon's work is more up-to-date, more advanced. So her work should be better than Garstang's, more accurate than Garstang's. So all the scholars accepted Kenyon's interpretation and forgot about John Garstang's results. But as we will see, Kenyon was wrong in her dating. She did a lot of very good work there, and we appreciate the fine reports she's put out from the excavations, but her conclusions, unfortunately, were wrong. Here we see on this plan the various areas that have been excavated over the years. Even before John Garstang worked there, there was a German expedition, and they dug the areas that you see in blue. I should say here that Jericho is the most excavated site in the Israel area other than Jerusalem. Jericho would rank second, and I think probably because of the biblical story we have about the walls falling down and the city being destroyed by the Israelites. And archaeologists have properly assumed that if we go there and excavate, we should find evidence for these events. But, of course, according to Kathleen Kenyon, no. According to her conclusions, there was no city there in 1400 or even in 1200 B.C., as Frank had mentioned in that earlier quote. So anyway, we can see how many areas have been excavated on this plan. And there's even been some more work done after Kenyon, and that is not on the plan here, but we'll look at some of that. So the blue, dug by the Germans, and their work is very important because they were able to trace that outer or lower fortification wall that you see there, that blue line running around the site. Over on the east, it had been dug away because they constructed a road over on that side. Also notice over there on the east, the reservoir, and that's the source of water for Jericho. The spring is right there. And that would have been inside the city walls at the time of the conquest. You can see how the blue wall would have continued around the outside here, somewhere out in this area. It hasn't been found yet, but originally the city wall went out in this area so that the spring, the water supply, was inside the city, and that's very important in time of siege. Then next, the Germans excavated this area to the north that you see, this big blue area, and we're going to have a look at that later on because they made some very interesting finds there. Then Garstang comes along in the 1930s. He dug the areas that you see in red, and in particular, we want to look at the area on the southeast slope right here, just above that spring. And he discovered there the remnants of the city destroyed by the Israelites. Up on top of the mound, that phase was gone. It had eroded away. And so the only place he found it still intact was here on the southeast slope. Garstang had also dug some trenches through the fortification system. You can see up to the north, to the west, even down in the south. And based on what he saw in those trenches, he concluded that there was a double wall that had collapsed. The outer wall had collapsed outward. The inner wall had collapsed inward. And he thought that was the wall from the time of Joshua. He was wrong in that because, as I said, he didn't really understand the fortification system. When Kenyon did her work in the 1950s, she was able to show that those walls really dated much, much earlier than the time of Joshua. In fact, they go all the way back to the time of Abraham in the early Bronze Age. And so he did make a mistake there. But his work over there on the southeast slope was very well done, and he was correct in his conclusions based on his findings there, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But unfortunately, because he made this one error, scholars have tended to totally reject all of his work, all of his conclusions, and that's wrong. Then we come to the 1950s, and Kathleen Kenyon and her work, she dug the areas that you see in yellow. And in particular, we want to look at the West Trench. Here she again dug several trenches through the fortification system. We want to look at the West Trench. And incidentally, if any of you have been to Jericho, certainly you will remember the Neolithic Tower, which is at the eastern end of that West Trench. And the guides always take you over there, right to this area here. We are going to go to the other end of the trench, the west end of that trench, and see what she found there. And then you'll notice that she put in some squares just to the north of Garstang's big red area there on the southeast slope. And she found basically what Garstang had found, a big layer of destruction, which Garstang had dated to about 1400 and said this is the evidence for the conquest of Jericho that we read about in the Bible. But Kenyon said no, that was dated, it should be dated to about 1550 BC, and there was no city there at the time of Joshua in about 1400. So we're going to examine the evidence and see what it has to tell us. Here's an aerial view of the site. And we're looking north to south here. When you visit the site, what you see are the trenches and the squares of Kathleen Kenyon. You don't see anything of Garstang's work. And I mentioned there was some later work. An Italian team went there in the 1990s, and they opened up some areas, and we'll look at one of them. Of course, they're still visible yet today. Now, Garstang found a series of what we call Egyptian scarabs out on our display. You can look at some of these scarabs. They're small amulets, and many times they have on them the what we call a cartouche, which is kind of an ellipse, which contains the name of a pharaoh. And not always. Sometimes there's just design. Sometimes there's a personal name in there or the name of some official. Originally, they were used as seals. They were mounted on a ring, and then they were used to seal documents. But then they became used as good luck charms, amulets, and so on. And so we find these fairly often in our excavations in not only Egypt, but also up in Palestine. Garstang found a whole series of these going from the Hyksos period, which is the time when the Israelites were in Egypt, all the way down into the 15th century BC, down to the time of the Exodus and the conquest. So here we see some of those scarabs, Hatshepsut over there on the left, number one. Then two and three, Thutmose III, he was the next pharaoh after Hatshepsut. And then we have Amenhotep III, numbers 4 and 5. So this series extended from this Middle Bronze period or the Hyksos period in Egypt all the way down to the end of the 15th century B.C. and suddenly that sequence stopped. These scarabs were found in tombs in the cemetery just very close to the site. And Garstang had excavated a number of burials in the cemetery that had scarabs from the 15th century B.C., the late Bronze I period, archaeologically speaking, the time of the Exodus and the conquest. And so he was able to date the pottery found in association with these scarabs, And then when he excavated up on the Tell, and he excavated that destruction layer there, he found that same kind of 15th century pottery that he had found in the tomb. And that was the basis of his dating of the destruction of Jericho to around 1400 BC. Now, he had some other arguments, but the pottery dating is the main argument. And that analysis that Garstang did and published is very good and solid and still should be considered today as the basic analysis and work to date the destruction of Jericho. Here's some of those scarabs. I believe these are in the Louvre in Paris, and then there are some also in the Rockefeller Museum in Israel. They're not on display. You have to go back into the basement of the museum and get special permission to get them out and look at them. Here's a photo of Garstang excavating one of those tombs where he found those scarabs and where he found that 15th century BC pottery. And here's some examples of the pottery. I show on the left some of the bichrome, in other words, two-color pottery that Garstang had excavated that was in that destruction level. You can even see traces of burning on some of those sherds. And this particular type of pottery is very important because it was only in use toward the second half of the 15th century BC, the time the Israelites were attacking Jericho. And on the right are examples of pottery from Kenyon's dig in those squares to the north of Garstang's area. And again, this type of pottery dates to around 1400 BC. Well, now, why was Kenyon so far off in her dating? She said the city was destroyed 150 years earlier. And here's perfectly good late Bronze I pottery in her excavation report. What's going on here? Well, that was the question I had when I first embarked on this study of the material from Jericho. My PhD thesis was on Canaanite pottery of the late Bronze Age. Wonderfully interesting topic. I'm sure you would jump at the chance to read my thesis on this subject. But it's very important for dating. We use pottery for dating in Palestine. We don't find written documents. We find a few of these scarabs, but they're quite rare. So we have to depend on pottery. And a sequence has been worked out, and based on the style, the decoration, the shape, and so on, we can date pottery to within 50 years or so, or 100 years, depends on the type that you're talking about. Well, when I went back and read through Kenyon's reports, the first thing I learned was she never published a detailed analysis of her pottery, number one. Number two, in the few statements she said or made about the date of that destruction level, she talked about what she didn't find. She said, I did not find imported Cypriot pottery that was in use in the 15th century BC, late Bronze I period. She said, since I did not find this kind of pottery, I assume nobody was living there at the time. Well, that is an argument from silence. That's a very dangerous argument. What you have to base the date on is the ordinary, everyday Canaanite pottery that was in that destruction level, and she never looked at it, she never studied it, she never paid any attention to it. She was just looking for this fancy, very nicely decorated pottery that came from Cyprus. And in fact, scholars or archaeologists at that time in the 50s were more or less dependent upon that decorated pottery for dating. And my thesis really was a study of the everyday, ordinary Canaanite pottery, because that really will give you the date, because this imported pottery, many times it was kept as heirlooms, and we find a lot of it in tombs, but it was not the kind of material that you would find like in a poor area such as was being excavated here at Jericho. And so the dating really based on the Canaanite pottery, is 1400. Kenyon was simply wrong in her dating, and in fact, Garstang was exactly right, because he studied that Canaanite pottery, the local everyday wear, and he had these scarabs which provided a very good date for him. So that's the basis of the dating, and I'm not coming along and doing anything new. I'm just saying Garstang was right, Kenyon was wrong, and that's the whole analysis that I'm working on. It's a study of the pottery, and there's other factors, but the main argument is the pottery. Well, once we get that date correct, and we of Jericho was destroyed in 1400 BC, that archaeological level there dates to 1400 BC, and then we start looking at some of the other things that were found in that time period, we see that everything lines up beautifully with what we read in the Bible. Let's begin with the walls. Of course, the Bible tells us how the Israelites walked around the city of Jericho once a day for 6 days. Then on the seventh day, they walked around 7 times. And then the priest blew the horns. The people shouted. The walls fell down. The men charged up into the city, and they set it on fire. And that's the end of the story. They had captured this heavily fortified city of Jericho. Well, here's a kind of a schematic drawing of the fortification system as we now know it, based on the work of Kathleen Kenyon. You can see that the sites, the tell, as we call it, this ruined heap, it's just a buildup of many layers, one on top of the other, of the many cities that were built there over thousands of years. The earliest city, according to Kenyon, goes back to 8000 BC. That's based on radiocarbon dating, so there's a big question mark about how accurate it is, but certainly it goes back thousands of years. And so at the time of the conquest, we see it was surrounded by this earthen embankment. And it was held in place by a retaining wall, a stone retaining wall that went right down to bedrock. On top of that stone retaining wall was a mud brick wall. And then at the crest of the embankment was yet another mud brick wall, as you see. Now, Jericho was not a large place. We keep getting questions about numbers, you know, how many Israelites there were. We got this question last night in our presentation at a local church here. The Bible says 650 elephs. That's the Hebrew word, and it's usually translated 1,000, 650,000, so that would mean maybe maybe 3 million total. But I doubt very seriously if Aleph had that meaning at that time in the early books of the Bible. I think it meant more like a unit, particularly a military unit, and it probably had a much lower value. And scholars have estimated maybe the total number of Israelites was something like 20,000 that came out of Egypt. Now that's a lot smaller than 3 million, but still 20,000 people is a very large number of people to come across the wilderness and then to be attacking Jericho, 20,000 being the total, so the number of fighting men, maybe 6,000, I don't know. They had several thousand fighting men, no question about it. And so when we get here to Jericho, we find that the upper city up on top was about 6 acres. If you take into account the surrounding embankment, it was maybe 12 acres. You can walk around Jericho in about a half an hour. I haven't gone all the way around, but the people who've done it tell me it takes about a half an hour to walk around Jericho. And so how many people lived there? Well, in 6 acres, the rule of thumb that scholars use for a city like this is about 100 per acre. So that's only 600 people. Well, of course, in time of siege, in time of warfare, the people living around the city in the little agricultural villages, they would all come into the city for protection. And so there would maybe be a few thousand total people living in Jericho. The Israelites, 6,000 men, would have, I think, a numerical advantage. At any rate, Jericho was heavily fortified. They had a water supply inside, so they could hold out probably for years inside this fortified city. Why can I say that? Because we have records from the Egyptians. They campaigned in this area. They attacked these walled cities, these Canaanite cities. They laid siege to them. And it took them a long time. Egypt was the most powerful nation in the world. They had the greatest army at this time in the late Bronze Age. It would take them sometimes 3 years to conquer one of these heavily fortified Canaanite cities. So this is what the Israelites were up against. Here's a cross-section through the fortification system. The blue shows the earthen embankment. The outer wall here is the retaining wall going all the way down to bedrock, about 15 feet high. On top of that, the red mud brick wall. It was actually pinkish in color. Kenyon describes it, and we'll quote her in a moment. It was about 2 meters wide, a little over 6 feet wide. And another rule of thumb that we use in archaeology is a wall would be about three times as high as it was wide, at least, sometimes four times. So the height of that wall was perhaps 20 feet on top of the 15 feet for the retaining wall. So the ground level outside here, right here, is where the Israelites were standing as they marched around. So they're looking up at this stone facing, if you will, not a freestanding wall, but it's a retaining wall, 15 feet high. On top of that, another mud brick wall, 20 feet high. And then this very steep earthen embankment going up to the crest of the tell. And there, another mud brick wall about 6 feet wide, probably 20 feet high. And so this is what the Israelites were looking at as they walked around the city of Jericho. And you have to wonder what they were thinking. And what were their thoughts as they're walking around? Whoa, I don't see how we're going to conquer this city. You know, how are we going to get through these walls? You know? But they did what the Lord told them to do. They marched around there for those 6 days and then seven times around on the seventh day. And those walls, we're told, came down. In fact, here is the eyewitness account from Joshua 6:20. The people shouted, priests blew the trumpets, and when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the walls fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. Now, when we look at the Hebrew here, concerning what happened to those walls, almost every translation that I've looked at has the same thing. The wall fell down flat. But that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew, it's actually takhaha is the word that's used there. It means the wall fell beneath itself. Beneath itself. And we'll see when we look at the findings of archaeology that that's exactly what happened. You see how these walls were kind of up high and they collapsed, they fell down, and they were deposited at the base of the tell. That's what the archaeologists found. So those walls fell beneath themselves, just as the Bible describes. And then what happened? The people, that is the men, the fighting men, went what? Straight ahead into the city? No. They went up into the city. They had to climb up that embankment to get up to the top of the tell, to where the main upper city was located. And so it's clear from this description in the Bible that this is not something that was written hundreds of years later, a story made up about the ruins, a folk tale, or whatever you want to call it. This was written by somebody who saw what happened. Otherwise, you would never know that the walls fell beneath themselves, that the men had to go up into the city. This is an eyewitness account of what took place there. Here's that retaining wall. This was exposed by that Italian expedition in the late 1990s, and you can see the height of that retaining wall. And then at the base, as I mentioned, they found mud bricks. All of this is collapsed mud brick all through here. And every expedition who has dug at the base of that retaining wall has found exactly the same thing, mud brick collapse. And here we're looking down onto that retaining wall, which is on the right side there. There's a nice one of these cable cars that goes up to a monastery, but it takes you right over the Tell of Jericho, kind of neat. And here's that West Trench that I talked about that Kenyon dug in the 50s. She came to this same retaining wall, and there you see it, and you can even see remnants of the mud bricks from the first layer of the wall on top of the stone retaining wall. She dug through that, actually, and came to an area outside. This is right after the Italians exposed their portion of that wall, and on top they found mud bricks as well, and I'm pointing to one there. Unfortunately, the weather has taken it away, and the last time I was there, you could not see any remnants of those mud bricks. This is Kenyon's bulk drawing of that West Trench, and it shows us in yellow the remains of the earthen embankment. The black shows us that retaining wall, and look at the pile of red fallen bricks. It says right on the bulk drawing, fallen red bricks. And then Kenyon describes those bricks like this. The first tip line, that is kind of the line of the collapsed bricks, was fallen red bricks piling nearly to the top of the revetment, that is the retaining wall. These probably came from the wall on the summit of the bank or the brickwork above the revetment. So she recognized that these bricks, this pile of collapsed red bricks, were from the city walls. And you would think a light would go off in her head and say, oh, that's what this says in the Bible. No, because for her, this took place 150 years before Joshua. It had nothing to do with the Bible. But, as I pointed out, her dating was wrong. And so here we have the evidence for the fallen walls that the Bible tells us about. Now, the Israelites, as I mentioned, were at ground level with this big stone facing there in front of them. How did they get over that? That didn't fall. That wasn't a wall. That wasn't a city wall. That stood. It's still there today. You can see it today. Well, the way the city walls fell and collapsed, they formed a ramp. So the Israelites could just simply climb up over that pile of fallen wall, up over that retaining wall, up the embankment, and into the city, just as the Bible described. And you can see in the bulk, this is the Italian bulk, the line of that pile of red bricks. Doesn't show up too well in the photo, but when we were there right after they did the excavation, it was very, very clear. What about Rahab's house? If the walls fell and her house was part of the city wall, wouldn't her house have fallen? You remember how she let those spies out through the window in her house because her house was, in this translation, on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. That's not quite an exact translation. You read other translations that say she was living in a corner of the wall, between the wall, or some such thing. The Hebrew here actually says her house was built against the vertical surface of the city wall. That's the exact precise translation of the Hebrew. And so what did the archaeologists find? Well, here's the story of how the spies were let down. How they were rescued, excuse me, after they went back to Joshua, and then the army came, they defeated the city, and then they went in and rescued Rahab and her father because the spies said, bring your family into your house. Put the red rope out the window so we'll know that's your house, and we will come and rescue you and your family, and that's what happened. So how was her house preserved? Here's an artist's rendering of how her house would have been built up against the lower mud brick wall. In the north section of Jericho, all of the expeditions found that the city wall, for a short space on the north, did not collapse. And here we see the Germans and Garstang found that wall still standing to about 20 feet in height. Here's that stone retaining wall, and above the figure there, you see the mud brick wall still standing in the 1930s to a pretty good height. And this is a photo from the German work around 1909. And you see on the right there lower the retaining wall above it, remnants of the mud brick wall. And then on the ramp, the rampart, the earthen embankment, buildings, houses, some of them built right up against the lower mud brick city wall. And so this apparently is where Rahab's house was located. God protected that section of the city wall. It didn't fall everywhere else around the city. The wall fell down. So again, we see God's miraculous timing and how he had control of the forces that were at work. I believe it was an earthquake. So here's an artist's rendering of that section on the north with the houses on the embankment, some of them right against that city wall. Here's Wilbur Fields. Many of you know or have heard of Wilbur Fields. He worked with us over there in Israel at our excavation at Ai. And here he's standing on top of that retaining wall sticking out in the area of Jericho. Well, then, on the southeast slope, both Kenyon and Garstang found remnants of the city that was destroyed by the Israelites, and it had been burned thoroughly. Here's Garstang's excavation, digging through some of those buildings. And when you go to the site today, you walk right through his excavation area up to that little kiosk, which allows you to look down into Kenyon's area. And if you know what you're looking at, you can again look at that bulk. You can see these blue walls from that final phase and a big thick layer of destruction debris shown in red there, and again here in another balk drawing the west balk. And there's a cobblestone street and wall floor surfaces and so on, and the destruction layer. And then we have an abandonment phase, and then finally a phase from the time of Judges chapter 3, the time Eglon built his palace there. Well, this is Kenyon's description of the burning of the city. First the scripture passage, and then we have Kenyon's description. We don't have time to read through that, but it was a complete destruction. And she says the walls fell first. They had evidence of earthquake activity in the city, and she said the earthquake happened first and then the burning. That's the exact sequence we have in the Bible. And here is a shot of the balk there in Kenyon Square, where we see a bit of the cobbled street and one of the stone foundations from the walls. Everywhere the archaeologists dug in that section, they found great jars full of grain. Here we see some from Garstang's excavation. Why is that? Why was that grain left there? Grain was valuable. The Israelites were commanded by God not to plunder Jericho. It was to be offered up as an offering to the Lord. Well, the Bible tells us it was harvest time. That's why all those jars were full. And we have reference to it there, the flax stalks Rahab had laid out on our roof, harvest time. The Israelites celebrated Passover, spring of the year, harvest time. Here's from Kenyon's dig, her jars of grain that she found. And this, again, agrees with the biblical account that the time of the destruction was in the spring, harvest time. The jars were full. The siege was short, just 1 week. People didn't have time to use much of that grain. How did those walls fall? This is a question a lot of people ask, and different people have different answers. Well, it's from the marching of the feet. You know, they set up vibrations, and eventually over a week's time it brought the walls down. No, it wasn't that. It was the blast from the trumpet. The sound waves brought the walls down. Well, the bottom line is here in Hebrews 11:30. It was because the Israelites believed God, obeyed God, and then He is the one that brought the walls down. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. So here's a wonderful spiritual lesson for us. We all have walls in our lives, don't we? Things that we can't seem to deal with and are just too hard for us to take care of in our own strength. But if we trust the Lord, put our faith in Him, He can give us the victory, just as He did the Israelites in 1400 BC. Thank you for your attention.